By the ARRL RAC field organizations and countries within IARU Region 2. The X stations residing in other regions may be contacted for credit and may submit entries as checked logs. For Field Day 2023, several rule changes have been made. It's a good idea to make sure your logging software has been updated to the most current version to incorporate these new rule changes, including updating the Canadian sections list. There are many
This is Jim Sklavunis of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre.
Early Electromix is a series to document the history of experimental electronic music from the 50s to the 80s. Pioneers who paved the way for what was to become techno, ambient, electronica, and most of what we are listening to. Essential Culture on air every Tuesday from 11 to 12 a.m.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit DedicatedPresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Spike's Record Rack in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Who is community radio for?
It's for people.
You mean it's for the people?
What's the difference between people and the people?
People you see on the street are people. You can see them. You can't see the people. There's too many to see.
You can't see anything on the radio anyway.
That's what's great about radio. There's nothing to see.
That means you can drive at the same time you listen to the radio.
Do you think it's safe to operate a motor vehicle while listening to WGXC?
Is it safe to use power tools while listening to WGXC?
90.7 FM. WGXC.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Raga Justin reports in the Times Union that with Democrats in Albany locked in negotiations to produce a new budget, State Senator Jake Ashby, a Rensselaer County Republican, has a proposal for the state's bail laws he hopes breaks the deadlock. Ashby would eliminate cash bail altogether, but give judges discretion to hold dangerous alleged criminals. People accused of crimes are considered by the courts innocent until proven guilty, but the current bail system puts these innocent people in jail. Ashby's proposal would remove all references to cash bail from New York's criminal code. Judges, though, would get sweeping oversight over when to remand someone accused of a crime before their trial. And his proposal would create a commission on public safety reform to analyze court data to give judges an objective standard they could use to determine how to evaluate someone's perceived risk of harm to themselves or others, or their potential to leave the court's jurisdiction. Ashby said, and I quote, "It takes money out of the equation, and it gives judges the discretion that they need. I think it makes an attempt to solve or alleviate some of the concerns on both sides," end quote. Katie Schaefer, the director of organizing at the Progressive Center for Community Alternatives, called the measure a, and I quote, "mass incarceration," end quote, bill, and said, and I quote, "Senator Ashby's proposal would dramatically and unconscionably expand pretrial incarceration in New York State, undermining our constitutional right to the presumption of innocence. We urge New York's legislature to reject this radical and regressive proposal, as well as the governor's efforts to jail more black, brown, and poor people pre-trial," end quote. Governor Kathy Hochul has not commented on Ashby's proposal, but on April 5th said, and I quote, "I support the fundamental premise behind the bail laws, but we need to make sure that judges understand that they have the discretion to make the right decision in the right case," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Jamal Cutler reports in Columbia Green Media that the town of Canaan's Park will get spruced up with a $6,000 grant from the Partners for Climate Action Hudson Valley to remove invasive species and restore plantings. On Earth Day, workers will begin adding native wildflowers and shade tree plantings and removing European water chestnuts from the park pond. Dylan Chipkowski, Canaan's Climate Smart Community Task Force member, said, and I quote, "The pond is an essential part of the park. It creates a lot of beauty, and it's a wildlife habitat, and it's used by people for fishing. The water chestnut grows at a fast rate and outgrows other native species of plants, making it hard for them to persist in ponds, lakes, and rivers. That impacts wildlife, fish, and people. The water chestnut makes it hard for people to fish," end quote. Canaan will be adding Blazing Star, Brown-Eyed Susan, and other native flowers and grasses such as Blue Stem and Dwarf Fountain to the 7-acre park. Partners for Climate Action co-founder Bob Dandrew explained why Canaan won the grant, saying, and I quote, "The project in Canaan was attractive to us because it involves volunteers from throughout the community. We believe that it will be inspiring to other towns in the county," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Courtney Ward reports for WTEN that it is spring and the Department of Environmental Conservation is warning about the possibility of muddy trails. There is still snow and ice melting at higher elevations, and the DEC is asking hikers not to hike above 2,500 feet until the trails have dried and hardened. And the agency warns that hiking on muddy trails damages the environment. DEC Forest Ranger Peter Evans said, and I quote, "So really pay attention to what you're doing. Make sure that if you're going to try to cross a brook or something like that, you take not only the current weather pattern, but the weather that's going to be happening in the afternoon and early evening into account," end quote. Read the full story at the WTEN website. One sign of spring is the reopening of the drive-in movie theaters, and the Highway Drive-In in Coxsackie announced on social media this week that they will start screening films again next weekend on April 14th. They will announce the first films they are showing on April 11th. The Greenville Drive-In has not yet announced when it's opening, but that is typically in May. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC renewable weather forecast for Sunday, April 9th. And we begin each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The Mobil in Caro has gas at $3.39 a gallon. That's the lowest according to the Gas Buddy website. The water temperature in the Hudson River in Albany is at 43.5 degrees. That's about a degree warmer than usual on this date over the last 10-year average in the Hudson River in Albany. National Weather Service in Albany predicts that high pressure will continue to remain just west of the region for Easter Sunday, resulting in another dry and sunny day. Skies will be nearly completely clear once again, and temperatures look to be milder than the last few days, with highs in the 50s. Should be another calm and chilly Sunday night, though. Lows in the 20s. And a little milder on Monday, as sunny skies remain in the area. And temperatures reach into the 60s. Drop into the 30s on Monday night. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson. Solar-powered radio for open ears.
Talking today with Michael Ewall, who is the executive director of the Energy Justice Network, and along with the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, on April 3rd, they filed a petition to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, that it should finally start requiring waste incinerators to report their toxic chemical emissions as part of the agency's toxic release inventory. Michael, why is this an important issue?
So, thanks, Mark. This is an important issue because a lot of times there are things that come out that talk about what toxic exposures are there in a community. For example, ProPublica did a great toxic map for cancer risk about a year ago. And if you zoom in and look at that and try to find your community, well, a lot of communities won't see things that should be on the map because some of the most toxic industries, waste incinerators, have never had to report to the database that EPA uses that that map was based on, which is the toxics release inventory. So there are just a lot of places where the largest or one of the largest polluters is a trash incinerator in any given city or county. And that data is just not there. So that's part of it, is that we're not getting the full story. Another part of it, though, is that that database goes more thorough than other ones. So there are other places you can find that information for what goes into the air, but you can't get in any place the information on what toxic chemicals go down the drain or into ash that gets dumped in a landfill or some other place that is also inappropriate. And that is one of the major new disclosures we'll get once this, once EPA requires this industry to report to this database. So for example, if you're living in a landfill community and you're getting ash from somewhere, you might be able to figure out how many tons of ash from what incinerator, but you won't know how many pounds of mercury and dioxin and lead and arsenic are in that ash. Now they'll have to start reporting that information.
So we were talking earlier, and you know, you stated that, you know, some forms of incineration are, you know, presently required to cover. We thought particularly that the Norlite has this waste incinerator, which is, you know, also an aggregate production facility, probably is already required to report some of this. What are some of the other incinerators beyond, say, garbage incinerators that would fall under this proposed rule?
Sure. So in the Clean Air Act, there's a section called Section 129, and that covers several different types of waste incinerators, and that is what has been exempt from the start. So plants like Norlite, they have to report because they're either a manufacturing sector or mining sector, or if they were a standalone hazardous waste incinerator, they would have to report because of that, because that falls in a different section of the law. But all the types of incineration that are not technically classified as hazardous waste, but are still dangerous, are the ones that are exempt. So that's what we're asking them to add. And that includes large and small trash incinerators, hospital or medical waste incinerators, sewage sludge incinerators, what they classify as commercial and industrial solid waste incinerators. They also have a category called other solid waste incinerators. And finally, pyrolysis and gasification units, which are types of incinerators that they often say are not incinerators. The industry likes to say they're not incinerators, but they're still defined and regulated that way and are very similar to, you know, more typical incinerators. These are the advanced recycling or chemical recycling plants that are often trying to process plastics into fuels that we keep hearing about.
Now, I actually was involved in the effort to shut down the Albany Ansys garbage incinerator in Arbor Hill back in the mid 1980s. But, you know, at that point, it certainly seemed like the State Department of Environmental Conservation was very pro-incineration. And, you know, one of their arguments, well, burning things at high temperatures is the best way to destroy them. But does a lot of the things that are shoved into these, you know, different type of incinerators, including garbage incinerators, are they actually destroyed or do they emerge some other way?
Right. So there is a lot of public relations around this industry. There's a long history. When I first got involved, when I was in high school in 1990, I was hearing in the news about a trash to steam plant that would be built in my home township. And I was in favor of it. I thought, well, if they could turn bad things into innocuous things or even good things, then why not? Well, it took until I started studying it to realize that is not what they do. People are not throwing ice cubes in the trash can. We're not only getting steam out of smokestacks. Same thing when they call it waste to energy, like they do for a lot of trash incinerators that produce modest amounts of electricity, because really what they're doing is they're turning trash or other kinds of waste into toxic ash and toxic air emissions. So every pound that goes in comes out, and all the bad things that go in, all that mercury, arsenic, there's PFAS in there, all of that stuff comes out. If they're elements, they won't change. But if they're PFAS, some of it might get broken down, but you don't destroy it. You just change its former location. So you put a PFAS molecule in there, and it's that fluorine in there is still going to come out, if you're lucky, as hydrofluoric acid, which is still not a very lucky thing to be breathing. So that's one of the chemicals that has to be reported to the toxic release inventory, and we hope to make that disclosure more available.
Now, I know you realize you're national, but you've done quite a bit of work, I know, in Albany County about air quality issues. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the, you know, facilities we're looking at in New York? I believe there's quite a few garbage incinerators. I met one of your staff people recently who was talking about the incinerator down in Westchester County. I'm pretty sure there's one up in the Glens Falls. So, you know, what are some of these, you know, facilities that we know about in New York State at this point?
Sure. So New York is now tied with Florida for the status of number one in the number of trash incinerators. Florida used to have 11, but one closed. So now they're down to 10. And New York has had 10 for quite a while. Back 12 years ago, there were still these 10 incinerators operating. And at the time, the New York DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, studied and found that compared to the 8 coal power plants that used to exist in the state, all of those shut down, but the 10 trash incinerators are still running. The trash incinerators were far more polluting per unit of energy than the coal power plants in the state. On mercury, it was 14 times more, which is pretty astounding. So these 10 incinerators, there are 4 on Long Island. There are 3 in the Hudson Valley. Those 3 are all run by Wheelabrator, the second largest incinerator company in the country. And like you said, there was one near Glens Falls, it's actually in Hudson Falls, and there's one in Poughkeepsie and one in Peekskill. And then there are 3 others in Western New York. So there are those, plus New York also is one of the top states in sewage sludge incinerators. So you have those scattered around the state as well, and some other types that might fall under this as well.
Now, in terms of the toxic release inventory, is this a case of, you know, self-reporting by the, you know, the polluters as to how much they're emitting, or there's actual, you know, independent smokestack emissions that take place?
Well, I wish I could say for anything, and even if the toxic release inventory becomes a requirement for this industry, that would change how things are tested. It will not do that. The testing in this country is horrifying if you realize what really goes on. None of this is being done by anyone independent. Companies pay for their own engineering companies to do the tests for them. So that's not independent if they're the ones paying the bill. It's not the state that comes in to do it. And for any toxic chemicals, they are not monitoring on a continuous basis. They will test about three or four things at most smokestacks with continuous testing, and that's stuff that is not considered toxic, but is carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides that trigger asthma attacks, and sulfur dioxide that also causes respiratory and other problems like acid rain. But when it comes to mercury, dioxins, most other chemicals, all these toxic metals, acid gases, those things, if they're tested at all, and usually about maybe 8 to 10, maybe 12 are tested at a lot of facilities like incinerators, they test them one time a year under their best behavior. And they're not even allowed to do the test when they're having worse emissions, like during startup, shutdown, and malfunction times. So they basically create the best case scenario, run their tests, they run a few of them. They can even and often do discard results that come out really high because they say, oh, there was an anomaly there. Okay, we'll rerun the test. And then they say, this is what we're like all year, which is complete baloney. And we know that because we've seen studies like out of Europe, where the most toxic chemicals known to science that largely come out of incinerators, dioxins, the actual amounts of dioxin when you use continuous testing, which we don't do in this country, in one study are 30 to 50 times higher than what we think they are when we test one day a year.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. And so we've been talking to Mike Ewall, Executive Director, Energy Justice Network. You have a website, people want more information?
Yes, if you go to energyjustice.net.
Thank you very much. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
On Tuesday, April 4th, advocates rallied at the Capitol to protest a massive frack gas pipeline expansion proposed in Greene and Dutchess counties at a time when the world needs to halt the use of fossil fuels to avoid climate collapse. The group called on Governor Hochul to deny a request for a state air facility permit for the Iroquois Pipeline Company's expansion by compression proposal. The decision is due April 11. If approved, the frack gas expansion proposal would increase the volume of gas that is pushed through a 37-year-old pipeline that runs 414 miles from the New York-Canadian border south into Long Island and New York City. The expansion would double the size of polluting frack gas compression stations in Athens and Dover, as well as two more in Connecticut. We hear first from Kim Frazek of Sane Energy Project, the MC for the event. Other speakers were Mary Finneran of Greene County, Charlie Quimby of Concerned Citizens of Dover, Carrie Gardner, who lives near the Athens Compression Station and is a member of the New York Progressive Action Network, and Emily Skyell of Food and Water Watch.
One of the major projects right now happening in New York State is what is called the so-called Iroquois Pipeline. The name Iroquois Pipeline is absolutely irresponsible, absolutely disgusting for them to be naming a extractive fossil fuel pipeline after the Iroquois Nation Confederacy. Bottom line. So right now, the Iroquois Pipeline Company is asking to expand their pipeline that is 37 years old, 414 miles long, that starts in Canada and goes all the way through New York State, Athens and Dover, then enters into the state of Connecticut, underneath the Long Island Sound and back into the metropolitan area of New York City and Long Island. We say no. They want to expand compressor stations in the towns of Athens and the town of Dover, and then also in Brookfield and Milford, Connecticut. We are here to shut down the New York portion of this pipeline, because if we shut it down here, we shut down the entire expansion project. Governor Kathy Hochul and her Department of Environmental Conservation, yeah. Commissioner Basil Sagos, to deny Iroquois Pipeline Company's request for an Article 19 air facility permit to poison our air. I am going to introduce the Sierra Club. She's from Athens, New York. Mary Finneran.
But I do know that there is evil afoot in Albany. Say National Grid is behind the heinous Parker Barrettville. Please know they are also one of the two clients. Know that they are one of the two clients for the ill-conceived Iroquois enhancement, more appropriately expansion by compression project. Henceforth, I will say EXC. The other client is Con Ed. The EXC project, original Iroquois pipeline, was built. It incurred the second largest fine from the EPA at the time, next to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, due to its truly shoddy construction. Despite the fine, the pipeline's construction, shockingly, was never rectified. So to plan to double gas going through such a lousy pipeline is really begging increased GHG and toxic fugitive emissions breaches and wars. But in 2018, in Massachusetts, there was an explosion where 40 homes were destroyed, 130 buildings were seriously damaged, and an 18-year-old young man lost his life. Amazingly, the only death among the many injuries. The NTSB declared it to be the direct result of a huge increase in gas to an old pipeline. Exactly what the EXC project would do.
You mentioned the EXC project. That stands for Expansion by Compression. So what's happening on this pipeline is they want to expand, double the size of compressor stations. And what compressor stations do is they take gas from that's flowing in a pipeline and squeeze it really tight so it builds up a lot of pressure and it pushes it down to the next compressor station down the pipeline. At those compression points, spews out lots and lots of cancer-causing chemicals in the air. And the next person that is going to come up and speak here lives right across the street from the Dover compressor station, and to add insult to injury, the Cricket Valley fracked gas power plant that is majorly invested by multi-billion dollar multinational corporations in the middle of a beautiful rural community that is aching to just focus on farm for their economy. So I would like to bring up Mr. Charles Quimby, who's one of the most extraordinary activists I've ever met.
Over 30 years ago, the Iroquois pipeline ripped through our state and across my town of Dover. They divided farmland, cut through streams and rivers. They broke environmental laws and disregarded proper and safe construction methods. Their acts were so egregious that Iroquois executives and their subcontractors were brought up on felony charges. They faced a massive fine by the EPA, second largest, only to the horrible and horrific Exxon Valdez oil spill. Iroquois paved the way for environmentally degrading land uses in Dover, including junkyards, landfills, and industrials that contaminated our land and the drinking water at our schools, and leaving a mess of superfunds and polluted sites. Iroquois provided the infrastructure for the next round of devastation to our town. Cricket Valley Energy, the massive fracked gas. The cycle continues, and now Iroquois is coming back for round two in our town of Dover. Many towns and villages that this pipeline runs through are areas of environmental justice concern and disadvantaged communities, including Athens and Dover. We already face high environmental hazards and burdens. Now these same communities are facing another, a dangerous and aging pipeline, where they propose to increase the pressure to near the maximum operating limit. Iroquois destroyed our town, and we are here today to tell them no, not again.
From the New York Progressive Action Network, I have known Carrie for many years. We fought the Spectre pipeline together that's going right near Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant.
Much of Athens is directly downwind of this project and will suffer the worst results of increased gas pressure. We know that even without the planned expansion, people have had health impacts throughout the area because of normal compressor station maintenance. If this plan succeeds, there will be more methane and particulates emitted into the air, further increasing health risks for those living within miles of the compressor station. There is also that the dangers from a possible pipeline breach or worse. We have repeatedly stressed that this project will not provide any advantage to the local community. difference, right? The footprint of the project will not increase in size, so no new taxes for Athens. The jobs during implementation will be for outside temporary expert workers. The jobs of local residents currently existing for the compressor station will not go away or be replaced. Of course, another huge downside of allowing this project, in addition to health risks, is the increased risk